everybody. Welcome to today's edition of Brain Trust, Conversations in Clinical Psychopharmacology. I'm Dr. Joe Goldberg, Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York. Our format here, as hopefully you've come to know, is conversations with eminent clinical psychopharmacologists who are talking to practitioners, clinicians, people interested in translating what's topically relevant scientifically in clinical psychopharmacology that you can put into your clinical practice and just understand a little bit more about where the field is at now, where it's heading, and how to stay on top of things. So it's a real pleasure for me to have us joined today by a longtime friend and colleague, my friend from Harvard, Dr. Roy Perlis. For the next 15 minutes, I'm going to briefly read Dr. Perlis's CV, or at least a few of the highlights. Besides being the Ronald I. Dozeretz MD Endowed Chair and Professor of Psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School, Massachusetts General Hospital, Roy is Associate Chief for Research in the Department of Psychiatry, Director of the Center for Quantitative Health at Mass General Hospital, where his work looks at clinical and genomic predictors of treatment response and the development of novel therapeutics. Roy has fairly recently become the Editor-in-Chief for Artificial Intelligence at JAMA Open Network. He is an associate member at the Broad Institute. He's an affiliate faculty at the Harvard Stem Cell Institute. I could go on, but our topic for today is going to be the role of artificial intelligence in clinical psychopharmacology and what that means for all of us who may not necessarily know what that necessarily means. My background, so Roy is a clinical psychiatrist who sort of cut his teeth from the clinical trials world and mood disorders, and then sort of moved in many directions that have gone both into the translational world as well as the clinical world. I think Roy speaks the language of both sort of science and technology, but also clinical applicability. So Roy, thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Joe, and thank you for wading through that that list of titles.
Well deserved. So look, enough about you. I want to say a word about me. One of the reasons I became a psychiatrist was at some time in my youth, I had the idea that if I was a really good psychiatrist, I could make predictions about the future, about what's going to happen to people. I had this idea in my head that if you really understand everything there is to understand psychiatrically, you'd have some edge like X-ray vision or some prescient knowledge of what's going to happen. So I guess my first question to you is, the knowledge of artificial intelligence and machine learning give people like me a chance to realize that fantasy that if we could really comprehend big data, we'd be able to make better predictions about things like what's going on with the patient diagnostically or treatment-wise and basically feel smarter than we may otherwise feel?
So you started with an easy question, huh? Well, let me say the way that I started working in this area was that as an undergraduate, I'd done what we used to call machine learning. And then early in my career as a psychiatrist, working with Maurizio Fava, I was interested in just what you're interested in, which is, can we look at data, in this case from fluoxetine trials, and predict who was going to respond better to SSRI. Now, this is 25 years ago. We were playing with neural networks. We put all the data from our fluoxetine trials in, and we found a whole lot of nothing, like so much nothing that when you see this much nothing, you think like, what are we missing here, right? So I would say the last two decades have been watching the technology mature, watching the data mature from an era when we had data on 20 people or 100 people or 200 people to the STAR-D era when all of a sudden we had several thousand people to now when we can do these studies across hundreds of thousands or even millions of people with depression or data from hundreds of thousands of people with depression. And I think we still struggle to find things with AI that if we thought deeply as clinicians, we couldn't figure out on our own. So, you know, I'm clearly an enthusiast. I think AI is really important. I do think it's going to change how we practice medicine, but I'm also something of a realist. And I know that if I asked you, when you see someone in your office, how do you decide how they're going to do, or how do you think about how they're going to do? At the moment, you probably would do about as well as any of the models that we might build. But the question is then, so why bother building the models? And I'm going to give you two answers. One is, even the act of aggregating things we already know can be useful. So you might make predictions based on simple things. How many past meds have they tried? Do they have anxiety? How old were they when they got sick? Things like that. But it may be harder to quantify that. So as a clinician, you're thinking, this makes me a little more worried, a little less worried. What the models will do maybe for you is put a number on it, which can be helpful.
Like a weighted coefficient, like I put a little more emphasis on severity, a little less emphasis on age at onset, or.
Exactly. And the other thing to understand is not everybody can be Joe Goldberg or one of the other experts who we work with. And so I suspect that one of the other major benefits of these models is to kind of democratize that knowledge so that everyone is an expert in treatment-resistant depression, or at least everyone has that knowledge base in treatment-resistant depression that right now is sort of hard to access. So I don't know that we can do better than you at this point, but we can make more people maybe do as well as you in terms of predictions.
Now, accolades for anybody aside, artificial intelligence involves training or teaching a system to learn from the knowledge that's inputted into it, right? So big databases could be taught by, let's say, quote, experts. What do they do, and how do we imitate what they do, and how do we sort of learn nuances? But big data could also come from, like you say, zillions of data points that may or may not have accuracy. I wanted to ask you, when you've done studies, for instance, looking at natural language processing based on, say, chart notes, and the person writing the notes says, well, the patient's psychotic, or they're manic, or they're this, or they're that. That's as good as is the accuracy with which the note person taker is detecting something. Does that mean that, well, yeah, if you've got a gazillion people, it'll all come out pretty much in the wash because you got enough power and enough eyes and descriptors that you can make those generalizations? Or are we really at the mercy of how accurate our observations are from which the system is learning?
I think you put your finger on the key issue. People used to say in the computer world, garbage in, garbage
Garbage
out.
out.
And our notes, they are what they are. I would argue, and often do find myself having to argue, that they still have face validity, right? Like a clinician evaluated this patient and the clinician thought they were psychotic. And absent the kinds of very systematic assessments, which are still pretty imperfect, I'm inclined to go with face validity. So I'm inclined to trust that the person seeing that this individual thought they were psychotic, there was something going on. But I think it does place something of a ceiling on our ability to make predictions. And that's something I think even in among people trying to build these models tend to forget that if it's not in the note, it's, these models are good, but they're not magic. If the doc doesn't write something down, the model can't necessarily guess that it's there. And so, for example, we're constrained. If I'm, so good example, Tom McCoy and I, one of my collaborators, were building models using narrative notes to predict suicide or suicide risk. And the issue is, we can't use anything other than what the clinician thought was important to put in the note. So, all of the things that you might think about in evaluating someone with depression or anxiety should be in the note. But if it turns out there's some other predictor that we never thought of, if it's not in the note, we're not going to find it, right? Like we can only find the things that people write down, and what they tend to write down are the things that someone taught them are important to document in mood disorders. So it's like it's the old thing about, looking for your keys under the lamppost because that's where the light is. The stuff that we're building predictors from are the things that are easy for us to measure and that we were trained to measure.
So is this, but does this also get into the power issue that, yeah, there'll be excellent people and not so excellent people, but if you've got enough eyes, and in big data, you're talking astronomical numbers, or at least far more than a few hundred, even a few thousand. Does that make AI invaluable in the sense that you're getting closer to the population as opposed to the sample? You've got enough eyes. Presumably, if you had all the eyes in the universe, that is the population. And so even if they think what they think, you're approximating as best you can with what the vast majority of people think. How much does that sort of sample size, so to speak, make AI indispensable to these questions?
I think AI lets us use the data that make better use of the data that we have, right? There are things. So the predictive models that we use are not all that much better in general when applied to data at the scale of a few hundred thousand people than logistic regression or linear regression. And I always sort of chuckle as an editor when I get submissions that now talk about, a machine learning approach to X or an AI approach to X, and it's regression. Regression works wonderfully well for a lot of things. I don't think at this point it's a power question. I think we're coming up against the limits of documentation. So, for example, we've done some work with our colleagues at Vanderbilt and Geisinger on using health records to predict treatment-resistant depression. And we don't do very well. We do okay in our system, but doesn't translate very well, or it's not very portable to another system. And, really looks like we're coming up against a ceiling when we look at what's in the health record. It's still better than chance. I mean, there is some signal there. And something I hope we can talk about is instead of pursuing these perfectly predictive models, there's a ton we could do with models that are just okay, just better than chance in terms of sort of targeting resources, right? So the like chasing the AUC of 0.8 for TRD, it ain't going to happen. On the other hand, to tell me who's high risk or low risk and therefore who should go see the specialist versus who can stay in primary care, I think those are the kinds of tools we could have right now. What I was going to say, though, as far as the this TRD collaboration, I think the problem is the data, whatever the predictors are that would let us do really well, it's not coded clinical data, and it's probably not in the narrative notes. Some of that's there, but I think it's probably, I don't know, you tell me. Maybe it's a blood test, maybe it's EEG, although I doubt it's EEG, with apologies to some colleagues. I think that there are probably other biomarkers out there, or even other, passive measures that would be useful to incorporate, or even scales that we just don't collect routinely. You know that years ago we built a pretty good predictor using STAR-D of TRD, but it included scales that clinicians don't use. Fast forward 20 years, we still don't use those scales. So I think the answer is not, give me a million electronic health records and I'll build you a better predictor. Because again, with our colleagues, we've used hundreds of thousands of records and not, it's that it's not in there. It's just not in there.
Let me throw another wrinkle. I think I hear you and agree. Let me throw another wrinkle into this issue of the substrate from which information is extracted. So, depending on whose notes and what context one is looking at, I often think about the extent to which notes are fair and accurate portrayals of what the clinician thinks, as opposed to written from the standpoint of things like medical necessity or procuring ongoing support, say to keep somebody in a certain level of care. Back in the days when I would do inpatient work, I always marveled that the patient continues to deny SI, but we're not quite sure, and they're still at risk. And then they're going home Thursday. Their SI is gone on Thursday, or even an ICD code. Let's suppose there's a medication I think could be very beneficial for somebody, but it's not reimbursable under a particular diagnosis or procedure code. Anyway, you kind of get my sense as to how much notes get written for reasons other than clinical data.
So remember that Epic was billing software. Epic evolved from billing software, from software that was intended to be sure that hospitals could collect as much as possible from a given service. And so it sort of follows from that that the notes in many ways are serving multiple purposes, only one of which is clinical communication. I mean, I'd like to think there is still signal in there where I'm trying to tell you, Miss or Mr. Future Doctor, Future Clinician, here's what I think. But yeah, between medical legal and billing and all the other things that these notes are expected to do, the amount of signal in all that noise is getting smaller. By the way, since we're talking about AI, a preview of coming attractions is that with ambient scribes increasingly part of clinical care, where an AI scribe records the visit, transcribes the visit, and generates the note, something we're seeing is an incredible amount of note bloat, where the length of notes in the electronic health record is growing, but more and more of it is the kind of writing that you'll be familiar with from ChatGPT, where it's sort of empty or not especially specific. And so we may soon be at a point where you actually need AI to read the AI-generated notes and pull that signal out that's harder and harder to find.
So it may not be necessarily all the face value documented notes, and it may not be an EEG or a traditional biomarker, but if we're thinking big in AI and machine learning, what about digital phenotyping? And suppose, you're trying to argue a proposition which thinks wrong with the patient, but maybe you need their smartphone to support the fact that their sleep cycle is disrupted or they're hyperkinetic in their movements. And so what you're calling psychosis may just be agitation or akathisia. In other words, could AI help refine what's actually going on in ways that the observer may not even realize, but a smartphone could help?
I am a tremendous believer in these easily collected passive measures. I think when someone suddenly stops using their phone, or starts using their phone more, or starts using their phone at 2 in the morning, yeah, that's telling you something. And I think the key insight over the last few years is that people have finally shifted from, we're going to build a model that looks at your phone data and says you're depressed, or that says you're psychotic, to everyone is different. This is time series data. What we really need to know is this different for you?
Compared to
So,
yourself.
in other words, I actually think it's hard to look at somebody's phone use and say you're manic, because some of us use our phones too much, some of us use them very little. I think it's way easier and probably more valuable anyway to say, I notice you usually use your phone for about 15 minutes a day. You're using your phone for 5 hours a day, or you're using your phone at 2 in the morning. That doesn't necessarily tell me that you're manic, but it sure as hell tells me something's going on. And this is not rocket science. Like, you don't need fancy, you don't need fancy AI to make those kinds of predictions, right? Like, actually, we were talking about linear regression or logistic regression. Simple linear classifiers would actually do pretty well in saying something's going on. And so, yeah, I absolutely believe in passive data. The trick with passive data is linking it to the rest of our health system in a way that is actually useful to clinicians and patients. So years ago, people started bringing in their Fitbit data or their sleep data, and they'd, hand me these printouts and so on. And I mean, it's great that people are taking that much responsibility, but I think the real breakthrough will be when I sit down at a visit, I open Epic, and I see, and I mean, even better would be not opening Epic, but I open whatever the health record is, and there's a, you know, there's a red light because someone's phone use has changed substantially, or someone's, you know, their number of steps per day has changed substantially. In other words, that the problem is integration. We have the data, we have the tools to process it. It's the how do you get it into the record in a way that is helpful to patients, preserves their privacy, does not create an undue burden on the system to respond to all sorts of false alarms. I think that's where we are now.
You make me think also about there's a way to know erratic adherence. Didn't fill your prescription last month. Could this be withdrawal that you're identifying as agitation versus something else? Heck, I mean, how big can this go? Substance use? You may not volunteer information to me about your substance use, but I guess if one was writing a good science fiction novel from a mental health standpoint, you would have some way to capture all these elements and be able to make inferences, huh?
Years ago, I was giving a talk on some of our first natural language processing stuff at the Broad, and a fairly senior scientist stood up and said, "You know, but Dr. Perlis, is this really science or is this engineering?" She was sort of sneering as she said it. And the reality is, at this point, these are really important questions of engineering in the sense that the data are there, the technology is there, the integration with clinical practice is not there. That, I think, is where the real gap is.
Now, let me ask you a question, if I may, about what people like you and I would call hypothesis generating versus hypothesis testing kinds of questions. And I'm going to use a specific example. There's been much in the news lately about the FDA Adverse Event Reporting System, or FAERS, this gigantic, big database where everybody's anything that gets reported in pharmacovigilance gets identified. And there's been an uptick, in people kind of using that database to report associations of things that may or may not have meaningful, well, connectedness. So if I discover, oh my gosh, people that are taking VMAT2 inhibitors seem to have a lot of involuntary movements. Maybe there's a causal effect as opposed to it's failing to remedy the problem that I'm going after. Question is, how much does having a hypothesis a priori in mind need to be on the minds of anyone who's like reading the literature or dabbling in the AI world, and they read something somewhere about an association between this drug and this consequence, but it's not really a consequence. And some big database says, people that take drug X seem to have more of Y consequence, and one could be misled into a causal connection as opposed to an association. You know what I'm saying?
I do. So the first point I would make is, to their great credit, our colleagues at FDA have been very aware of the limitations of FAERS for a long time and have encouraged efforts to develop ways of doing similar work using electronic health records that are a lot less susceptible to certain kinds of reporting biases, right? Because in a sense, we're collecting much of this data in real time every time we start someone on a new medicine. And so, you know, I think FAERS has its place, but as you point out, there are a lot of challenges in interpreting the data in FAERS. I think, though, that the underlying difficulty of confounding by indication, right, is hard to. With electronic health records is still a problem. We have a little bit more control over it because we know more about people, so we can kind of adjust for the indication for the medicine. You know, so the example that often comes to mind is you look at the adverse event profile for psychiatric medications, and they have a lot of psychiatric adverse events associated with them. And that's because perhaps the symptoms that are being treated are what's being reported, or we're looking at them in a population that is at greater risk because of their illness for certain kinds of outcomes. So I think confounding by indication is a tremendous problem. I think It's important to consider the plausibility when you look at these, when you're doing pharmacovigilance work, and ideally to have a hypothesis. I think people get a little bit confused about why we do pharmacovigilance. You know, one reason to do pharmacovigilance is that when a drug is marketed, we don't necessarily know everything that we're going to come to know about it. So we need some way to continue to learn, right? I mean, there's just so there is a need for unbiased or non-hypothesis-driven surveillance. That said, I think in electronic health records in particular, I can do an analysis one way and show you that this drug increases risk, and then I can turn some knobs and all of a sudden it decreases risk. And people don't necessarily understand how susceptible these approaches are to bias. And that's why I'm much more convinced when there is a mechanistic story, right? Then when your priors for something being true are higher. So we need both, but we need to be really careful about what we're doing. And for the surveillance part, for the like, let's just see if anything pops up, we need an appropriate level of skepticism, which unfortunately seems to be lacking lately.
So let's take a step back. You have been working in this space and contributing to it long enough to maybe tell our listeners something about, are there viable candidate markers to predict, let's just say, antidepressant response at this point? Or if I was going to ask that question of ChatGPT or chat box, what are the known predictors of response apart from the litany of, well, severity and chronicity and comorbidity and are all the things that will diminish responsivity? Is there an algorithm that's going to be out there at some point, or any way the average practitioner might leverage AI to help them think about anticipating responsivity in a given patient?
I think that it's not so much. So, where I think it can be helpful at this point is just making sure we haven't missed anything, right? Is my diagnosis right? I mean, you know, from all the years treating people with TRD, sometimes it's TRD because that's not the right diagnosis. Likewise with bipolar, sometimes it's treatment resistant because that's not the right diagnosis and we're treating the wrong thing. I think what AI can be helpful for is making sure we haven't missed something. You know, did we look for symptoms of hypomania? Did we look for substance use? What's going on with their thyroid? So I actually think, you know, some of the things that you started to reel off, I think AI can kind of keep us, it's a little bit like an autopilot on a plane where hopefully the person flying the plane actually does know how to fly the plane, but the autopilot makes sure that you don't do something dumb or inadvertently, you know, try to take off without the right settings in place. To me, that's a lot of the initial value, less so than the prediction. I do think there are maybe opportunities to identify who's much less likely to come back for a follow-up visit or much less likely to be adherent to treatment. So, you know, in our work, we've actually sort of moved away from truly predicting response as kind of a biological outcome and more trying to predict the aspects of care that will contribute to response, but, you know, maybe not in such an elegant way. To figure out, like, who, if I start them on a medicine, is never going to come back. Or who, if I start them on medicine, is never going to fill a second prescription. Because those are the things we can predict. You know, one of the things, actually, one of the points I wanted to make earlier is that when we started doing treatment-resistant depression work in health records, naively, I thought that people in the real world might look like they do in clinical trials. Where you come in, you get started on a medicine or some other intervention, and 8 weeks later, you're either better or you're still depressed. And of course, that's not in health records as in the real world. That's not how it looks. So what we found when we started doing that work was most people ended up somewhere in between. And so that makes it hard to look for predictors because I thought we'd build a classifier of remitted, still depressed. And we end up with a few remitters, a few still depressed, and everybody else kind of in the middle. That's not ideal when you're trying to build a classifier, especially because we don't really do a great job of documenting ongoing symptoms, to your earlier point. And so, especially in that era, we didn't have PHQ-9s on everyone. I would say PHQ-9's not such a great measure anyway, although best we've got in many of the records that we see. The point is, it's often hard to build things that kind of predict that middle status, but that's where a lot of people seem to end up.
So risk calculators, I always think about like a Framingham score, or I guess nowadays that might be the pooled cohort risk equation. And if you're really, I'm no cardiologist, but as I am an intelligent layman who follows this a little bit, the more things you can put in that are relevant, like your coronary calcium score and your smoking status and family history, you get a number at the end, because gazillions of people have had their data crunched that I can say to you, the odds you're going to have a heart attack, probabilistically, not deterministically, but probabilistically, are X. I had a patient who came in recently whose primary care doctor did a pooled cohort risk equation. And the question was, would it be safe to give them an atypical antipsychotic with metabolic risks, given that they could benefit? But their pooled cohort risk equation person said, well, I have like a 9.3% risk of an MI in the next 10 years. Is that a fair way to think about how one could use AI as a risk calculator, or what are the shortcomings of that logic?
Well, certainly, as you said, the cardiologists love that, right? They're very excited about those numbers. And I think they think that if you give people those numbers, you'll change their behavior. It's a little bit like the argument being made to use genetics in cardiology, where if you tell someone you're high risk for an MI, they're more likely to, eat well and exercise. I'm a little skeptical of those nudges, to be honest. I think you could probably get almost as much bang for your buck just telling people you really should eat well and exercise, or even better, showing them how they could exercise more. So I'm a little skeptical of the risk calculators to begin with, but I will also say in psychiatry, we published a TRD risk calculator, I want to say 2013, and no one used it. And no one used it because it was in the first, it was in the biological psychiatry paper that used STAR*D data to predict likelihood of failure to response, failure to respond.
Was this the Peterson study from MGH?
No, this was one of my only solo author papers. I'm saying we, but it was like Perlis 2013.
Okay.
And the thing is, I don't think we really want risk calculators. I think we say we do. I think we'd love to be those, measurement-based care aficionados. I don't think we want those because I don't think we would know what to do with them if we had them. But, I published it more than a decade ago. Nobody ever used it. Then, Adam Chekrood and his colleagues went back and did something similar, but better. And again, nobody has really done much to follow up those risk stratification tools. And then, I noticed recently someone went back and did the same thing again, which, if I can rant a little bit, is sort of a problem in psychiatry that we don't actually pay attention to each other's work. We just keep, it's like machine learning in psychiatry is like Groundhog Day. It's like everybody wakes up and thinks, oh, wait, we could use this data to make predictions. Rather than, here's how our model improves upon the one that was published a year ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago. So I don't think what people want are risk calculators. That said, technology's out there, data's out there, the papers are out there. Anyone who wants to could sit down and turn regression models into, plug your information in here. I don't think we want them because I don't think we know what we would do with them. This is the other thing. Someone comes in to see you and they're a high risk for TRD, what are you going to do differently? And the answer for most people is, well, I'm going to follow them especially closely, right? Like, all right.
Well, what if the outcome of interest, sorry to interrupt, what if the outcome of interest was suicide risk, that ever elusive phenomenon? And there you are, resident PGY3 in the ER on a Saturday night, and so comes in, and we go through the usual litany of questions that every resident is, ingrained. What if there was a really, really good probabilistic algorithm, and it may even have things that you wouldn't necessarily think of, like, do you drink coffee from paper or ceramic mugs? Or are you vegetarian? I mean, we don't even know. But if you had enough of those variables, are you saying that there's no such idealism to think about? That if I had all the right questions, no probabilistic measure can tell you deterministically what's going to happen to this person. But if I could predict with 90 something percent probability that this person, because they wear blue jeans and went to school in Ohio, has a higher risk, will that someday inform, I better admit them, or I'd better think about ketamine or something based on that massive probabilistic algorithm that you're not so sure we want?
So, I think if we could build models that are that good, they would absolutely be valuable in clinical care. My skepticism comes from our ability to build models that good, and my concern that what we're deploying instead, and suicide risk stratification models are being deployed. People are trying to push them into emergency room care, and what makes me anxious is they're not very good. We've built some of these. We've been building them for a long time. The reason we haven't, in my group, pushed to make them part of clinical care is I want the pilot flying the plane. I want the clinician doing the evaluation. As soon as I have something that's better than the clinician, you better believe I want to push that to the front lines. I do think that those approaches can be valuable in helping even the most inexperienced or non-specialist clinician know what to evaluate. So, sure, as something that pops up a red flag to the poor ED doc who's been up for 8 hours and, hates dealing with mental health, but is the only person to evaluate the patient, I think there's value there, right? If it pops up and says, hey, you need to ask them about X. But I think in terms of using those to weigh an admission decision or a referral to ketamine, we're just not there. Nor do I think we're going to be there soon. And what I worry about is all of the efforts to push this stuff into the clinic prematurely, you'll see a backlash and you'll see people get frustrated and kind of over-reliant on tools that just aren't good enough yet.
Fair point. I've heard the phrase something like AI or chat boxes can hallucinate. What does that mean? Do you know?
So I will tell you that as a psychiatrist, we know it should be confabulate. It's not hallucinating, it's confabulating.
Never mind.
That is what they do. And by way of background, these models are trained to answer. They are trained to complete sentences. They're basically, large language models are like the biggest Mad Libs playing device you've ever seen, where their job is to fill in the blank. And most of their training data does not fill in the blank with, I don't know. I haven't seen that before. So it does its best guess. It makes its best attempt to fill in the blank with something. And in practice, that means that these models will hallucinate. They will invent references that don't exist or facts that don't exist that might be references that could exist, right? Like there's the title looks believable. The authors of the reference are real authors, real people who write in the field. The journal might even be real, but the reference doesn't exist. So these models will essentially create facts or fill in the blanks with facts, and So that's what hallucinating or confabulating is. There's been some progress in making it easier to distinguish when models might be doing that. So particularly in a clinical context, grounding the models in data, in a constrained set of data, and forcing the model to cite its work, to show its thought process, I think is really important. But it's definitely a work in progress.
And if the model is learning from itself, my language may be wrong here. There's a point where it says, wait a minute, this is contradictory to other information that I have. And so therefore I've identified a conundrum and I can't give you an answer because so and so says this, this says that, and there's divergence of opinion. It's sort of
With the,
interpreting things.
yeah, so with the newest models, with the so-called frontier models, there's more of an effort to get them to admit when they don't, or disclose when there's not a clear answer, and or to think through an answer. So one of the important two important developments that bear on hallucination in the last couple of years. One of them are the thinking models. So the language models that actually, instead of just answering, instead of just completing the sentence, are actually trained to think through, in a sense, or process through, what are the considerations here? What are the possible answers? What else might I be missing? Which can make it a little easier to understand how it gets from one point to another. The other development that I think has been really important, including for clinical applications, is, and I hate such a buzzword, but agentic AI, which is a fancy way of saying AI that can use tools. And the tool that's most relevant here is searching the web or searching PubMed. So, one way that you minimize hallucinations is to say, in your answer, search PubMed and provide me with the relevant citations. When I use language models in that way, I will also have them check each other's work. So I will take something that came out of one language model, give it to another, and say, check each of these. Do these citations say what the text says they say? So, and that's kind of when you talk about learning from themselves, that is, in a sense, multiple models that are questioning each other. And when you hear about these fancy systems that are developed for like AI doctor, AI scientist, though, that's how those kinds of systems work, where they're not like one query, one model. They're multiple models that are talking to each other, developing hypotheses, questioning those hypotheses. There might be a fact-checking agent that takes every assertion and says, well, is that actually in the literature? So even though, if you sit down and use ChatGPT or Claude or, your favorite language model, you have to worry about hallucinations. It is something that there's a lot of ongoing work to try to address.
And I guess those systems don't differentiate necessarily case reports from open trials, from randomized trials, from meta-analyses,
You
unless you
know,
specify that.
it for a company that will remain nameless, that has developed a very impressive sort of AI scientist model. I asked one of the developers, when you do your lit search, how do you distinguish between articles in higher or lower impact journals or labs or authors who tend to be more likely to do work that replicates or don't, right? Like how, this sort of credibility question. And the response was basically, oh, we don't. We treat all the literature as equivalent. So, I think the models that operate over clinical literature or research literature can make a distinction between the type of data, meta analysis, trial, whatever. But they're not very good at making a distinction in terms of do you believe the source, or how much do you believe the source?
Credibility, rigor.
Which I thought was quite interesting,
Yeah.
that if it's in the literature from a language model's point of view, it's truth, which is a little scary.
If it's in the literature, if it's in the it's on the internet, it must be true. My patients tell me
Absolutely.
that all the time. I read it on the internet.
Well, it's like TV, right? It has to be true if it's on TV.
So when I don't know something, which is often, but I want to look smart, which is equally often, I will go to PubMed, and that's or Medline, and I'll look and I'll say, oh, okay, well, has this or has this not been shown to be the case? Am I better off going to Open Evidence or Chatbox? Because, well, am I better off? I mean, if I want to be able to say to my trainees, or look this up, lifelong learning, go to PubMed. See what you can find. If it hasn't been studied, that means it hasn't been studied. If there's two cases in Bulgaria, where should we be looking, clinicians who want to answer these questions about stuff?
Yeah, so I think for clinical research and basic and translational, I still go to PubMed first. I think for clinical questions, I know a lot of people will go to something like Open Evidence or UpToDate as a starting point, right? And it kind of depends on whether you're looking for the answer or at least the sort of consensus clinical answer. Where I might go to something like Open Evidence or UpToDate? Or do I actually want to look at the underlying literature? Do I want to see the evidence myself? In which case, I think PubMed is a good place to go. I have been playing with using some of the language models in their sort of deep research modes, which most of them have, and giving a prompt like, search PubMed and summarize the literature on X for me. And I think we'll get there, but we're not there yet. So I still think we should be teaching our students to go to PubMed for the literature. I think if they want to then, need a clinical answer, sure. I mean, you can think of things like UpToDate or Open Evidence as useful summaries when you're in a hurry. But was it Reagan who said, trust but verify? They're generally right, but not always.
Two last questions before I let you go. This is wonderfully helpful for me. What do you say to the clinician who goes to ChatGPT or similar chatbot says, I have a 47-year-old chronically depressed patient using cocaine who had a stroke and is just got fired from his job and has taken this drug, this drug, and this drug, and is poorly compliant and uses the following alcohol. What should I do next? Some clinician out there might be inclined to type that into a chat box.
Well, so my first reminder is that most of the chatbots are not HIPAA compliant, and
Don't
so my first response would be please don't do that.
do that. But why not? It's easier than searching PubMed and having to vet the information.
I know there are some clinical references now that are HIPAA compliant. So I do think there are circumstances where people might be able to do those kinds of queries now. But I think my question with AI is always compared to what? So if it's somebody out in the community who has no access to a specialist and truly doesn't know what to do next, I guess I'd rather they have access to some information, ideally a clinical reference that's vetted, than just making it up as they go along. If it's somebody who can reach out to a colleague who maybe is a specialist, that would be even better. But I guess I think we in the academic world tend to overestimate for the average busy clinician how easy it is for them to get a good answer from a specialist in a timely way. So it's hard for me to be too critical of what should I do next if the alternative is to just, I don't know, wing it, which we do way too much of in psychiatry. But I'd rather it be a clinical reference at least
Well, is
than.
there a middle ground of so I did my little cheat thing with ChatGPT and it suggested that you might want to consider giving the patient Coppertone SPF 50 and then I can go from there to PubMed or to my colleague or to you, Roy, and say, ChatGPT said, you ought to think about this. I don't know. What do you think? I mean, would that be a using the tool as opposed to passively relying on the tool?
So that's where you get into the trust but verify thing. I think what we need to teach kind of the next generation of clinicians is how to iterate with these tools, how to incorporate these tools into their practice. Because basically, I remember the first time I saw a primary care doc when I was training, trying to sort out a rash with a patient. And he pulled down a textbook and he flipped through it. And I thought, how can he be showing the patient that he doesn't know what he's doing? And then I realized, like, that's quite a, like, imagine having that much skill that you realize, I don't know the answer here. And with the patient, I'm actually going to figure out what this rash is by flipping through the textbook. I think these are a little bit like very fancy, very like the best textbooks ever. And we've got to figure out how to teach folks how to incorporate them in their practice in a way that is still safe. And you
With
paid
critical
for it.
thinking.
Yeah. What there was a the FAA a little over a decade ago put out a directive, an airworthiness directive, because they were worried that pilots were losing the ability to fly without autopilot, that they were becoming too dependent on autopilot. And I know I've alluded to autopilot a few times today. I think the real danger is this sort of cognitive complacency where we start to trust this stuff too much. And I think there's real risk there because sometimes you got to fly the plane yourself. Sometimes, there will be circumstances where the even in the best models we've built so far, we've been doing a lot of clinical decision support work with language models. We'll still give the wrong answer about 10% of the time. Now that might be around what experts do too. It's not to say that even expert clinicians are perfect, but if you're getting the wrong answer 10% of the time or a bad answer 10% of the time, you better check on that. You better look for interactions and toxicities and,
So we're kind of like in the Industrial Revolution where people were afraid that the cotton gin was going to replace human beings and that technology was going to take over as opposed to give us a tool to work with. This is the modern version.
It's a tool, but we're going to have a lot of work to do to figure out how to integrate it in clinical practice. So it's an amazing tool, but it's also incredibly disruptive, not in a necessarily positive way. It is going to change how we practice for sure.
Fun stuff. Last question before we stop, Roy. Advice to younger psychiatrists or others in training who might want to learn more about this. Where should they go? What should they do if they want to elevate their knowledge here?
Well, I mean, this is where I would plug JAMA Plus AI,
Oh, please do, Roy. I teed that
which is
up for you.
JAMA's channel that pulls together all of our AI work. But one of the things it does, in addition to that content across the network, is actually there are explainers and reviews and things to really help people get up to speed. And I think, there the it's really important to understand at least the clinical application of this technology. So I think just trying to keep up with reviews and hopefully with sort of we're moving to a point where finally we're getting some real world evidence about how these tools look in actual patient care. So the good news is they don't need to worry as much about, well, what is this model? How was it built? What's under the hood? There should be much better evidence coming on, but what does it do? How does it impact care? And the things that we all learned about how to evaluate the literature, whether it's a biomarker or a new treatment, that all holds for this technology as well. So they know more than they think.
Roy Perlis, you are my chat box, you're my chat GPT. And for better or worse, I trust that you don't hallucinate or confabulate. And if you do, I may not know it, but that's on me, not you. You are a fountain of information and knowledge and experience and wisdom and fun to talk to, as always, Roy. So any final comments before we wrap up?
It's just a pleasure to be here, and thanks for saying so many undeserved but very nice things.
But I don't hallucinate either. At least if I do, I know it. But I'm pretty sure I wasn't this time around. So thank you again, Roy, and thank you all for joining us today. I hope you found this interesting and as lively and informative as I have on this episode of Brain Trust, Conversations in Clinical Psychopharmacology with our guest today, Dr. Roy Perlers from Harvard Mass General Hospital. And we will see you again very soon on this program. Take care for now.
This podcast is presented by Psychiatric Times, the number one psychiatric publication in the U.S. Visit us at psychiatrictimes.com for the latest clinical news, expert perspectives, and CME opportunities. Thank you for listening.